Good morning, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the day before the Republican presidential primary in New Hampshire, and we'll spend most of the hour focusing on the presidential race and this primary in particular. It's all things political, which you always hear on Mondays here on the Ideas Network. We have a great guest this hour. He has a historical perspective on the Republicans and worked actually in the Reagan administration. Jeffrey Lord is contributing editor of the American Spectator and was political director of the Ronald Reagan White House and also has been an aide to Jack Kemp. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we look at the many issues involved in this race. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And we start our show. Thank you very, very much for being with us, Jeffrey Lord.
It's my pleasure. Happy New Year.
Well, thank you. Happy New Year to you. It doesn't seem like a New Year. It's 45 degrees in Milwaukee. It's just weird. We have this weird weather.
Yeah. We have seesawed back and forth here in central Pennsylvania. I think yesterday was in the 40s, but we were down to 14 degrees the other day. So.
Oh, my gosh.
It's nippy.
Well, it's a winter. All right. Tomorrow's New Hampshire. And I have a feeling that he probably may not take it, but because John Huntsman's father has a lot of money, and I'm sure there are a lot of ads running in New Hampshire, and what the latest polls are showing, that Huntsman may do better in New Hampshire. He may be this person that all of a sudden we're going to be looking at John Huntsman a little bit more.
Right.
Do you think?
Well, it's possible. You know, I grew up in neighboring Massachusetts, and I confess I'm old enough to remember in 1964 when Nelson Rockefeller and Barry Goldwater were just relentless in touring New Hampshire and campaigning. And the New Hampshire primary went to Ambassador to South Vietnam, Henry Cabot Lodge, who never stepped foot in the state.
Oh, my.
And upset all the apple carts. So, you know, anything is possible here, and I'm not ruling that out. One little note that I heard last night, which you might be interested to hear on John Huntsman, apparently there's a bit of a an interesting sort of family event at work with John Huntsman and his father. And his father is apparently reported to have said that he wouldn't give any money to his son unless he was asked.
Oh, really?
Yes. Now, what does this mean? I guess this means that John Huntsman just is too proud to ask his dad for help. I don't know.
So he's
or
not...
he wants to do it on his own. But I'm led to believe that there's no massive infusion of John Huntsman Sr. cash into this in any possible variation under campaign finance laws that you could do it, which I think is sort of interesting.
It is interesting, and it might be a mistake.
Yes, yes, indeed. I mean, the great thing about places like Iowa, I mean, I know Iowa and New Hampshire get criticized all the time, but I do think that this is a great place for these people to do the retail politics here, that once they succeed, whoever succeeds at this stuff never gets to do again. You know, they are immediately swept up in an entourage of Secret Service and staff and television commercials, and their ability to do the retail politics and stand in somebody's living room and, get philosophically whacked over the head vanishes, and they're sort of in a cocoon. So I'm all for it. I think it's a great thing. And if it turns out to be Governor Huntsman, well, that would certainly be very interesting.
Yes, it would. I thought one of the more, in a time when everybody, a lot of people are asking for more bipartisanship, I thought Governor Romney's comment that John Huntsman's working in the Obama administration as ambassador to China should disqualify him as a candidate. What did you think of that?
Yeah, I'm not, frankly, a critic of Governor Huntsman on that. I'm not a big fan of Governor Huntsman's, but I don't think that's the reason he should be criticized. I mean, I happen to agree with him that if the President of the United States asks you to do X, you should do it. It doesn't mean that you are going to support his nomination or his election or anything else, and particularly a position like ambassador to China. I mean, this is a foreign policy position, as it were, a neutral position. It's not like he was asking him to be the chairman of the Democratic National Committee or something of that nature. So I just think that's a cheap and easy ploy here that Governor Romney, and Governor Romney's not alone, has taken at Governor Huntsman on this.
Right. So many of the candidates refer to the president you worked for. You were political director in the Reagan White House. Why is it that he is referred to so often, Jeffrey, and the Bush presidencies, even the first Bush presidency, is not?
Oh, yeah. There's no question in my mind. Ronald Reagan had spent, you know, the previous 40 years of his life, you know, coming to the conclusion that he was a conservative. In spite of, you know, the caricatures of the day, he was a very well-read man. He'd had a lot of experience in life. When you think, for instance, of his economic policies, he in the day, was a movie star, and he was losing 90% of his film income to taxes. And he began to have the, you know, the conscious thought, well, why am I knocking myself dead making these movies when I don't, you know, when the money goes out the door to the government? And from that, and then his experience at General Electric, he really became a thoroughgoing conservative who really thought through these issues. And what that meant is, once he was president of the United States, by the time he was there, he didn't need to be instructed on any of this. And what was interesting to me was, he was such a beacon here that the staff knew exactly how he thought. You know, you didn't really have to prod around and try and find things out, because he was so out there and so visible with this. And then we got to the Bush era, Bush 41, and then later Bush 43, I've met both of them. President Bush Sr. is such a lovely person and a gentleman and all this, but it seemed to me that it was about being president, managing the government. And that's not really a philosophy. And I think it's always doomed to failure when you approach it that way. I think that's what President Carter tried to do to some respect. So President Reagan is seen as, you know, the guy, the gold standard, if you will, of conservative presidents, and the man who had the plan, who did it. The plan succeeded from the point of view of a lot of conservatives, and I think now at history, the Soviet Union is no more, all of this, but it came from his, you know, very determined and very clear point of view that he'd had a lot of time to work out.
Do you see among the current crop of presidential candidates anybody who is Reagan-like?
Well, I think at the moment, and as a matter of fact, I'm working on my column for tomorrow.
Oh.
And you know, one of the things, particularly, which might be of interest since you're in Wisconsin, this is in the year 2012. We are marking the 100th anniversary of the sort of big split in the Republican Party between conservatives and moderates, and the battle between Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft. And of course, Robert La Follette played a huge role in this. And one of the things I was just going through was, in the 1920 battle, one of the people that they wanted to put on the ticket was Senator Irvine Lenroot from Wisconsin. And he was the choice, and the delegates rebelled. He turned out he was a progressive Republican. They rebelled. They put Calvin Coolidge on the ticket instead. And, of course, Calvin Coolidge wound up being president of the United States. So that there was no President Lenroot, and apparently it was a pretty close-run thing there for a while. I do think that's a long way of saying yes. I do think that both Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum, if this is the final three between those two and Governor Romney, I think two of the three are some variation of a Reagan conservative, absolutely.
Do you think that all these pundits are off the mark, and this is not Mitt Romney's easily, that both of those other candidates could give him a run for the money?
I do. Sure, I do. I mean, I think, you know, it's now apparent that what's been going on here is the Republican base, as it were, they want a conservative on this ticket, and they don't see it in Governor Romney. So they're looking for the other, mm-hmm. that mystical the other. And they've run through Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain and, you know, all these other people here, and now they're down to Gingrich or Santorum. And how that will play itself out, I don't know. Governor Perry, of course, for a while was the front runner. Same sort of thing. So, I don't think this is done. If this becomes not about Mitt Romney, but about, as Newt Gingrich keeps saying, you know, a moderate Republican, moderate Massachusetts governor, then I think, you know, there's a potential there. I even think there's a potential, slim, but I think there's a potential that it could be somebody else entirely.
Do you
still
really?
Not on the, you know, if they go back and forth, the last convention that I was at that was a, you know, a barn burner, as it were, was the Ford-Reagan convention in Kansas City. And that went right down to the wire. President Ford won by about 100 votes, a little over 100 votes. And I can tell you, I was there. That was a, you know, an old-fashioned political convention where there was horse trading and, you know, they wanted delegates and all of this kind of thing. The decision was not made anywhere else but there in Kansas City. And I think, you know, maybe slim chance, but, you know, you could find yourself in a stalemate situation here after we finish these primaries. And, you know, the call goes up for, you know, Paul Ryan or Chris Christie or whomever, and then, you know, people say, well, now you have to do it. There's no fooling around. We can't agree on these other people.
And who do you think it would be, Chris Christie?
I honestly don't know. I have to tell you, I don't know. I mean, he would seem to be one of the obvious ones.
Yes.
So too, I think, would Paul Ryan be an obvious one. But I don't know.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting, Jeffrey. We'll have to see if it becomes true.
I mean, once upon a time, these conventions were everything. And these, you know, people like, you know, the presidents there are in history as great presidents, the Lincolns and the Franklin Roosevelts and all this, they were not first ballot selections. You know, the thing went on for a while. And this has sort of been obviated by the primaries. And, you know, somebody overcomes somebody else, and by June, they have enough delegates, and so the convention becomes pro forma. But is it mathematically possible to induce a stalemate? Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. I thought there was a lot in the debate over the weekend, a lot of conversation about foreign policy, which I found extremely interesting because of the many issues. The candidates really seem to differ on whether or not we should send troops back to Iraq, whether or not we should remove troops entirely from Afghanistan, whether or not military solutions are good ideas. What did you think of people being all over the board on this particular issue?
You know, I don't think there is, with the exception of Ron Paul, I don't think there is all over the map. And I know Governor Huntsman has been, has something of a different view on this. But I view this in shorthand that all but Ron Paul, to some variation, are quote-unquote hawks. Or Reagan conservatives, if you will, on foreign policy, and that Ron Paul is the one, you know, incredible differential there, and that's where the real split occurs. And the rest is, you know, well, maybe we should do A, or maybe we should do B, or do C, or not do C, or not do B. But they're not arguing with the central premise that America is the superpower, the lone superpower in the world, and you know, we. For force of circumstances, have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. I guess probably the only one who talked about sending troops back into Iraq was Perry.
I didn't get to see the entire debate, but what's going to happen here is if it becomes a necessity, whoever is there will, if it's a Republican other than Ron Paul, would probably do that. I mean, let's remember that George W. Bush. In his debates with Al Gore, was saying, you know, he didn't want to be sending troops around the world, and he didn't want to be doing this and nation building, et cetera. Well, come September 11th, you know, he suddenly was in the nation building business. So circumstances change things, and it has to do, I think, with a candidate's sort of underlying philosophy on a lot of this stuff that I think is there and is relatively the same with all except Congressman Paul.
One more question from me, and then we'll go to our loaded phone lines. Governor Romney says repeatedly that America is becoming more like Europe. I'm not sure what he means by that. Do you know what he means by that?
Yeah, sure. What I mean, and this is the conservative pitch, basically, about President Obama, is that he's trying to make of America a European socialist style state, the Obamacare being the health care situation being example one, that we're inserting the government absolutely everywhere in American life, and that this is the way things are done in Europe, and there is a lot of resentment out there. Just this morning I was watching some couple who's apparently got a case that's going to hit the Supreme Court today, and they want to build a house somewhere in Idaho. and the EPA has rushed in and said, you know, no, you can't do it for the following 17,000 reasons. And, you know, it's that kind of movement here that I think is that Governor Romney is talking about, and I do think that strikes a chord. And again, frankly, you know, this is what Ronald Reagan was talking about when he was running for governor of California decades ago. So it's just only gotten, if you're a conservative, it's only gotten worse, and President Obama has hit the accelerator here. So I think that is the issue, and that's exactly what he's saying.
Two phone calls momentarily. Our guest is Jeffrey Lord, contributing editor of the American Spectator, political director in the President Ronald Reagan White House. He's also been an aide to Jack Kemp. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Tara Parker Pope, who is the creator and writer of Well, the daily health blog and weekly column for the New York Times. She wrote the Sunday Magazine piece, not yesterday, but a week ago, on why is it that people can, and so many people do, lose significant amounts of weight, and then the weight just comes right back. She has done a thorough examination of that, and she will be with us hour two. Some interesting shows coming up. Ralph Nader is our guest tomorrow for one of the hours. And on Thursday, this massive biography of Van Gogh. I know there's a more proper way to pronounce that, but I can't do it. I'll just say Van Gogh. You know who I'm talking about. The life of Van Gogh. All right, two phone calls for Jeffrey Lord, and we go to Jackie in Drummond. Hi, Jackie.
Well, you kind of answered some of my questions, but I have two, and I'll let you elaborate. First of all, I was wondering, when the Republican Party became so conservative on social issues, you know, abortion and gay rights, that seems to mask, you know, so many other real issues facing this country. And I can understand the fiscal conservatism, but pro-life and gay rights is not going to create jobs. And secondly, this is interesting, I have heard many Democrats say, I could live with a huntsman. Now, can you tell me why the Republicans couldn't live with a huntsman as a candidate?
Sure. First of all, I think on the social issues, it's the Supreme Court that basically, you know, set this up and drove this, the Roe v. Wade decision, and then I think it was Lawrence v. Kansas, which was not all that long ago, back in 2003, that impacts gay marriage. And I think that basically what you're seeing is a reaction to that. Now, I would agree that economics is always the first issue outside of, you know, war. Economics is always the first issue in a political campaign. So I do think that that's the driving force. But that said, when you have these Supreme Court decisions handed down, in other words, they're not done by election, they're done by fiat, as it were, in the eyes of a lot of conservatives, then that stirs the kind of social conservatism that I think you're referring to. And it is precisely because of what you say in terms of Governor Huntsman that a lot of Republicans are not thrilled with it. They don't think he's a conservative, bluntly put. So they think he's a moderate Republican or a Democrat of some variety or hue, and that's why there is a problem with him.
And what do you think of all the plans to stimulate, which really is, as you say, and everybody knows, the economy is what we need to look at here. Is there a plan of all the Republican candidates that you think would really create more jobs for Americans?
Well, you know, I confess, I have not had a chance to go through Governor Romney's 59-point program. But the essence of any Republican program, conservative program, is to get back to the idea of lower tax rates and lower taxes to make sure that people themselves have money in their hands, and that's what creates jobs. You know, no poor person ever worked for a poor person. They work for people who have more money than they do. The job always is to make this a ladder of opportunity so that people just step on the ladder and keep going upwards to whatever level they want to, you know, they are comfortable with and can work themselves to. The problem, as all Republicans see this, is that money is being sucked out of the system and fed to the government, and therefore you're leaving people with no ability to hire other people, et cetera. I mean, it's basic economics. That's a long-time Republican position. That was Ronald Reagan's position, and that is what certainly conservatives argue was the success of Reaganomics in the 1980s, and frankly, all the way through the end of the Bush era, and counting the Clinton era, taxes stayed relatively low. People had cash. They were able to create businesses, create jobs, et cetera. I go back to, if anybody remembers Senator Paul, the late Senator Paul Zongas from Massachusetts, who was a liberal Democrat, and he won the New Hampshire, this is not really remembered these days, but he won the New Hampshire primary over Bill Clinton in 1992. And one of his famous lines was that he says, "I don't understand my fellow Democrats. They love jobs, but they hate employers."
Thanks, Jackie, very much for the call. Patrick in Janesville. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I just wanted to, comment. When I was 18 was about the time that Ronald Reagan, my first time I voted for Ronald Reagan, and I had very, black and white views of the world. I am now 50, and I say I evolved. My views have changed. I think some problem with what I see with the Republicans, and I try to watch as much of the debates I can, although I would be the first to admit I'm not the most learned person that you probably will get as a caller, but I think I'm average. I get very turned off, that, especially with Romney, that everybody seems very disingenuous, and the fact that their views are so narrow. I go to church, and I consider myself a Christian. However, I have problems with a lot of the views that the Republican Party represents. As far as I consider it, what you would want, how you would want to treat other people, and what their views are.
On what issues? What issues, Patrick, concern you?
The gay rights. I'm not a gay man. I'm as average as you could be. I'm not a minority. However, I think I hope that people realize that they don't represent the population as a whole. They represent a very black and white view, and I hope people can see through that. You never know what's going to be around the corner for you. You don't want to treat people poorly, anybody. Mm. And I don't think they represent. I think they represent a very narrow view of the world, and I don't think it's what I would want anymore.
Thank you, Patrick, for the call, Jeffrey.
Patrick, I think here's the problem, and this is sort of a larger societal problem, if you will. And Senator Santorum gets, and I'm. Fairly familiar with him because he was, of course, my senator for 16 or 12 years, I guess. The view that a lot of people, I think, have of quote-unquote gay rights and same-sex marriage, I go back to the Supreme Court case that I mentioned earlier, which was, I believe it was a sodomy issue in Texas, and the Supreme Court ruled that people had a right to do whatever in their home, and I am not a lawyer, so forgive me here. But the essence of Senator Santorum's criticism about this was not about the rights of gay people; it was about the slow road to delegitimizing the marriage between man and a woman. And his point was that if you start down this road legally, and I happen to think he's correct, how do you then deny the rights to, say, three men and two women who want to marry and have a group marriage, or any other form of marriage relationship here that instantly puts all the rest of us in the world of being quote unquote bigots? That what is starting here by taking marriage between man and a woman off the pedestal where it's unique and of its own, you're now opening the door to all these other relationships, and you get into that exactly as you phrased it. You don't want to do anything to hurt other people, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what is the definition of that? If your daughter wants to have five husbands or your son wants to have four wives, are you fine with that? I mean, and I think that there is a societal concern here that a two-parent male and female situation is the best to raise children. That's what I think is driving this. That, I think, is the cultural conversation. Senator Santorum, I should also say, is certainly famous here in Pennsylvania for having a celebrated gay staff member who was, you know, quote unquote, outed by liberals. He was a black man and a very high-ranking Santorum aide. Senator Santorum did that, knew that he was gay. He has no problem with this kind of thing. The issue is the larger societal issue. And I think that where we cross the line here is trying to say, well, people are bigoted if they believe in the marriage between man and a woman. President Obama says that he believes in that. So I don't really get the problem. I mean, I understand what the problem is. This is the ongoing discussion, and it isn't going to stop with this election either, I don't think, no matter who wins it.
Do you not believe, though, that the country on this particular issue is moving very slowly, but is moving in a different direction to acceptance of gay marriage?
I do think that, but my concern, and I've had to deal with this in my own church. I belong to, I know some people out there in your audience will pass out, but I belong to the United Church of Christ, which is the same church, same denomination President Obama belonged to. And are just in a thumbnail, we decide things at the local level. So every local church, and unlike the Catholic Church, say every local church does its thing. And we just basically looked at the issue, and we have gay members of the congregation, and we just decided we weren't going to do anything with it. And that's you know, our own decision. We didn't take a stand, in other words, one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's moving there. But then the question becomes, and this is already Jonathan Turley, who's a law professor there at George Washington and a lawyer representing some polygamists, has already been in the New York Times saying, well, so if we're doing this for gays, why not for polygamists? And I know, having researched this, there are others beyond this who are making the same argument. So the question then becomes, if gender is not sacred, why is number sacred? Why two people? That's the issue. And frankly, I haven't met anybody on either side of this discussion who's got the answer for it. And my, you know, my liberal friends sort of get indignant at this and say, oh, well, that's out of the question. Well, it's not out of the question, certainly not legally.
And what about this particular issue, Jeffrey? Do you imagine that social issues like gay marriage will play a large role in the presidential election, or will it be the economy, the economy, the economy?
Oh, the economy. Absolutely. I mean... you know, if you don't have a job, frankly, it doesn't make any difference what you're gay, bisexual, transgender, Chaz Bono, or Rick Santorum with seven kids. I mean, people want a job, and all these other issues, and this has historically been the case, any other issue sort of pales in comparison to the economy if the economy is a huge issue. If things are going well, there's room for these discussions in a sort of national political sense, and they're sort of, you know, out there. But if they are not going well, then people, you know, they want to know what's happening with their family and why they
right.
can't work.
Yeah. Patrick, thanks for your call. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I want to get on to what our elections are doing to us as a nation, but the guests mentioned that all the Republicans in this race are all hawks other than Ron Paul. Did you see what Ron Paul had to say on that very issue the other night when they asked who is going to send troops back to Iraq? Ron Paul said, funny, I'm the only one who actually served. Out of all of those white males, Ron Paul is the only one that served his country. He would be the hawk. The other gentlemen are all what you would call chicken hawks because they took 4, 5, 6 deferments. Dick Cheney, just name them all. They all took deferments. Now, I'm talking about with the elections is Iowa and New Hampshire. The way we're running our elections is why we wind up with these lame, lame people running our country. This is a joke. Iowa and New Hampshire are 99.9% white. 99.9% middle class. The election should take place 6 weeks only, no primaries, and it should be a vote off.
All right, Jeffrey?
Well, you got a couple things going there. In terms of the chicken hawk issue, I hear this all the time, and I'm always reminded that it was the people who served in the military who gave us Vietnam. I mean, President Kennedy was a war hero from World War II. Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford all served in World War II, and we wound up with a disaster on our hands. So I don't think military service per se, and obviously it's a deeply honorable calling, but just because you have done it or not done it doesn't mean that you've got the right set of policies. That's number one. Number two, you might be right in terms of shortening the election span. I think you may be on to something there. But I would say, in terms of Iowa and New Hampshire, to the best of my knowledge, there are 100% human beings. And if you don't believe, as I certainly don't, that you classify people by race, it doesn't matter to me what their color is. I mean, I think that's irrelevant. I mean, you wouldn't say that just because, say, somebody represents an area with a lot of Latinos, that somehow it's illegitimate. All Latinos, all blacks, all minorities, all women, all gays are all human beings, and they all have a role to play.
Thanks, Ray, for the call. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. As a Democrat, I'm really scared that in the future somebody from my party might go out and fall in love and want to marry a donkey. But what I'd like to talk about today is another diversion, which relates to the economic issues. Rick Santorum, of course, is trying to Willie Hortonize people by talking about placing welfare people on jobs. But if you want to put people on jobs, you got to be able to do something and not just talk the talk, but actually do something. Romney, in the past, said that we should let Detroit go bankrupt, which is a demonstration of his economic incompetence. And on fact check, the AP did fact check, and four of the 10 largest Bain investments that Romney was involved with went bankrupt, costing people their jobs, their pensions, and their severance. And finally, after all of this, John McCain comes out, and this is a guy who picked his vice presidential candidate, and along with the leadership in the GOP, and he picked Sarah Palin as somebody who could be qualified to be president of the United States. And now he asks us to believe that Romney is also qualified to be president. And to me, the whole process just shows how they insult our intelligence.
Well, I guess I'm talking to a good liberal American here, and all I would suggest is that, you know, certainly conservatives believe that Sarah Palin was better qualified to be vice president than Barack Obama was to be president, which I think at this point has certainly well played itself out here. I mean, these are the primary differences. And in terms of Governor Romney, and again, I certainly have been critical of Governor Romney for a lot of things, flip-flopping and all of this kind of thing. But it's capitalism that provides the jobs. And there is no guarantee. I mean, what in essence I hear you asking for is a guarantee to a lifetime job. And that doesn't happen. You know, human beings are imperfect. The government is imperfect. Everything is imperfect. And the notion that we should just be perpetually highly taxed so that people can have crony capitalism or get lifetime jobs in the government somewhere, somebody has to pay for this. Somebody has to create the income. And when, like him or not, Governor Romney has been out there doing that. And that's a very important thing. And I would suggest that the reason Detroit has been in a problem is because they followed exactly these liberal philosophies for decades and decades and decades, and they've run themselves into the ground here trying to do it. So it never works. It never, ever works. And that, I think, is the larger point from people on our side.
Thank you, Jim, very much for your call, as always. Let's talk about the role of the government, and the candidates were asked this question in the debate. What is it that the government can do to stimulate the economy? Who has the best answer for that, and what's your answer to that?
I would say, you know, I will go back, actually, to Governor Huntsman. His economic plan drew some favorable plaudits from the Wall Street Journal here, but it does involve always a combination of low taxes and getting money back in the hands of people to create jobs. That is the necessary ingredient. That's how unemployment comes down. When you look at that unemployment rate, for instance, among black teenagers, I mean, it's very high. I mean, everybody thought, oh, because Barack Obama is black, somehow this is going to change. It has nothing to do with somebody's skin color. You know, you can be white, you can be black, you can be any color of the rainbow. If you're doing the wrong thing, you're doing the wrong thing, and you're going to result in high unemployment. And that's the situation that we've got here. Too much government, the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac disasters and all this kind of stuff, giving more mortgages to people who couldn't afford them, and the system folded in on itself. I mean, what could you possibly else expect? So Governor Huntsman has a good plan. I'm sure it's somewhere in Governor Romney's 59 points, although I wish he could get it down to, say, one or two. I'm sure the same thing, and ditto with Senator Santorum. I mean, they all they're all dancing around, in essence, the central core conservative proposition here of free market economics.
And when they talk about free market economics, the other word that you frequently hear is that there's too much regulation on private enterprise in this country. Is there, and can you be specific about what those regulations might be that are doing businesses in?
Well, I'm certainly not a businessman myself in the sense that Mitt Romney was. But when the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac thing was just a wonderful example of this, in a sense. The government passed regulations and said to the banks, you must do this. You must give people loans based on other than their credit history and their ability to repay the loan. Well, that done, the law was obeyed, the regulations were in place, and of course these loans went to people who couldn't afford them. So the whole system collapses. This is exactly, what's going on here really is the Mark Levin, the talk radio host, has been talking about a new book that he has coming out called The Meritopia. And the essence of the point here is that everybody is trying to create a society that where there is no failure, where there are no problems, that, you know, if the government just regulates something, everything will be fine. And what happens is the government regulates something. Campaign finance is a great example of this. Now they're complaining about super PACs. All these regulations create problems. And then they say, well, now we got to have more regulations. And it just keeps going on and on and on and on in an endless cycle. And at the end of the day, you don't have any economic productivity because of it. That's the problem here with this kind of thing.
Mike in Madison, hi.
Oh, hi there. Yeah, so I was just calling because the last point that the speaker made about the housing crisis being a result of too much government regulation, I was in Boston in the early 2000s, and one of the things that a group of people were involved with was trying to get more government oversight of these subprime loans to people who weren't able to pay them back. You know, we really saw the problem as banks being too deregulated and having freedom to trade, crazy derivatives and make loans to people who weren't able to pay them back because they knew that they could sell the risk because there was not sufficient government oversight. And that seems completely at odds with what the speaker just said. So,
have you gone back and taken a look at the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977?
I would
suggest you do this. This was what began to do this, and then it was accelerated with President Clinton, I believe, in 1999. And I've gone back and read the news stories and all this from the day. And President Carter and particularly President Clinton were saying, well, now we're going to get this money out there, and now people can get these mortgages. Well, once this was done, then this whole business of bundling these things and selling them on Wall Street, this took root as a result of this government policy. I mean, so it was the government that was the initial mover here, as is usually the case. So
that problem couldn't have happened without the deep banking deregulation that happened throughout the 80s and 90s. And then the idea that, you know, in the 2000s, banks didn't want to make these loans, but their hands were tied and they were forced to by the government, that just doesn't really make sense to me.
Well, it doesn't make sense. That's exactly right. It doesn't make sense, but that's what they were forced to do. If you go back and you look at the pleas, I mean, Barney Frank is on videotape. You can see these wonderful videotapes in this day and age on YouTube where he's insisting there's no problem. And you have people from the Bush administration saying, you know, we really need to get a grip on this. And Barney Frank and Maxine Waters and others on the House Finance Committee are saying, oh, no, there's no problem. This is just an attempt to sabotage Fannie Mae, and you're against poor people, and you're against black people, and all this kind of thing. And so nothing was done. I mean, they kept kept this from doing anything. I mean, they have a real large responsibility for this. And again, this is just basic. I mean, you indicated it doesn't make sense. That is correct. It doesn't make sense. It didn't make sense at the time.
But you would agree that some of those banks probably should have known better.
Oh, they should have known better, but the law is the law. When the law tells them they must do this, then they got to go do it. that I mean, they are bound legally to do it. I mean, it's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of in my life. I mean, how in the world, if somebody is making, say, $10,000 a year, can they afford a $200,000 house or whatever the deal was? I mean, this makes no sense. And the objective, again, the value here is a good value. The idea that people are better off owning their own home, that's a good thing. But you can't force that. The only way that you get to own a home is by going out and working and earning the money and buying the home and having the money to afford it, whatever kind of home you've got. It doesn't make any difference if you're earning $10,000 a year or if you're Donald Trump. The position is the same. When the government stepped in and mandated that people do this, that's when we began to have this problem.
Michael,
and it took years
really
for it to build.
2000s. I mean, if you're saying this was something that started in the 1970s, why didn't we have this housing bubble in 1985? Why did it wait until after the banking deregulation happened when they could bundle the risk and sell it? I'm just repeating myself. I'm sorry. Thank you for your comment.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike, for the call. We need to pause for a moment and we'll return. It's All Things Political. You always hear it on Mondays at 9 o'clock. Jeffrey Lord is our guest on this day before the New Hampshire Republican presidential primary. He has a close eye on this and has a close eye on politics and Republican presidential history as well, having served as political director of the President Ronald Reagan White House. He's contributing editor of the American Spectator and aide to Jack Kemp. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our number two of our program, if one of your New Year's resolutions was to lose some weight and you made the same resolution last year and you lost the weight and then you gained it back, a lot of people are in exactly the same situation. Why is it so hard? What happens to the body that keeps us from being able to keep the weight that we lost off for any amount of time? Tara Parker Pope wrote the cover story of the New York Times Sunday Magazine a week ago, and she will be with us to talk about that issue. Hour two of the show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeffrey Lord, our guest. Bill in Madison. Hi.
Hello, I'd like to challenge something that Republicans often say and what this guest said. They seem to always equate European economies as if it was Soviet Russia or something. Now, I've got a unique perspective. I've lived in both the western part of Europe, and back in the days when there was an Eastern Bloc, I lived in East Germany for a while. It had to do with my job. And I've seen what I see for the people on the ground is that in Western Europe, you have market-driven economies, you have large corporations, you have stock markets, just like we have. The government is involved in a lot more things, that is true. Taxes are higher, that is true. But for the people on the ground, you have poor people, rich people, middle-class people, but not the bone-crushing poverty that you have here. Statistics have shown that Denmark, Sweden, all those socialist havens that he hates so much, have actually more social and economic mobility right now than the U.S. has. They have better health care outcomes. They have better public schools. They have, and these are not opinions. These are demonstrable facts.
All right, let's get a response. Jeffrey.
How much are they paying to defend themselves militarily? The answer is we're doing it for them. So, in other words, what you're saying is that they have an ability to use money that in this country is used to defend the rest of the world, Western Europe, all the countries you've mentioned. I mean, the primary moving force in NATO, for example, is the United States. So, you know, first of all, they have a significant situation here where their income is not used to defend themselves because we do it for them. So that's number one that I would certainly say. If this were true, the United States would not. I mean, people are not flocking to go to Europe. I mean, where are all the immigrants from in this country originally? They came from Europe, and why is this? They wanted to get out of there. I mean, my ancestors, your ancestors, the ancestors of everybody in this country, basically were coming here because they feel that the opportunities are better here than they are in Europe. So I think the situation speaks for itself. Can you cherry pick here or there? Sure. When they want medical treatment, they come here. When they want to go to a prestigious university, they come here. When they want all these different things, they come here. And I would certainly agree that we do have a problem with our public education system. There's no doubt about it here. So there are plenty of things that we are doing wrong here within our own country when it comes to this. But I would say in terms of Europe and all this, they are depending on us to provide an umbrella, a military shield for them, and it costs a lot of money to do it. And they don't have the funds to do it, and we do it for them, which enables them to do some other things.
Governor Romney, thanks, Bill, for your call. Said in the weekend debate that he was appalled by the Obama administration decision to shrink the size of the military. Are you as well?
Yes. I mean, this is in terms of the Republican Party. This is a very interesting argument here with Ron Paul, and people like myself believe that Ron Paul is in fact not only not a conservative, that he's very much of a liberal when it comes to these concepts. But one of the key building blocks of Ronald Reagan, which frankly doesn't really have anything to do with Ronald Reagan per se, but it's what he called peace through strength. And you can go back and find George Washington saying that the best way to avoid a war is to be militarily strong. Weakness always invites aggression. Always. I mean, you could be the neighborhood bully. You don't have to be a country. If you are perceived by the neighborhood bully as the weak guy, they will zero in on you. It's human nature, which is deeply imperfectible. And unfortunately, human beings were a charming lot, but there are psychotics and vengeful people and really bad people out there. And it makes no difference, frankly, whether they're communists, Nazis, Islamic fascists, or the guy down the street who's beating his wife. Human nature can lend itself to this kind of thing, and you need to be prepared always to deal with it.
Marilyn in Sun Prairie, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, the original comment I had to make about four calls ago kind of has changed, because I guess, Mr. Lord, you just got done saying that the countries in Europe that are doing well as far as social programs are concerned is because they don't have a military to protect them, that we do it for them. So wouldn't that kind of disagree with what you just said, that the bullies will go after the weak ones? So if Sweden and Finland and these countries that have better social programs than we do in our what you call socialist countries don't have military might, wouldn't the bullies of the world be going after them instead of after America?
Well, they don't go after them because we protect them. And when we did not do this, there's a wonderful story about the Nobel Prize Committee, which is located, I guess, as I understand it, it's split in its headquarters between Sweden and Norway. And they were giving out prizes to people in the 1930s who they believed had avoided war and all of this kind of thing. And then, of course, the Nazis literally marched into the headquarters of the Nobel Peace Prize Committee in Norway, and there was no America there to protect them. Now, Norway hasn't been invaded since, and that's because the United States of America has done the job not only for Norway but these other countries as well. So military strength is a very, very key thing, and the fact of the matter is the Soviet Union knew that America was there, and that's why these things didn't happen again.
But you could ask, who is going to bomb Norway now?
Well, nobody, one would hope, because the notion here that if we just have some sort of perfect world, none of this is going to occur. There is no such thing as a perfect world. And any point in the world, anywhere, at any time, all through history, this is what happens. Somebody gets the notion that they can do X. The situation at the moment in North Korea is unstable, to say the least.
Right.
You've got a 20-something here who has absolutely no experience in the world, and he lives in a society where people are, you know, scared to death to disagree, and you know, they have all of these economic problems. They sell these missiles to other terrorists and all of this kind of thing. Well, of course, somebody like that could do it. You know, again, Adolf Hitler is the favorite example, but he's the favorite example because there was a day when nobody thought this was possible. I mean, that it was just absurd to think that some guy who was in a prison in Germany in the 1920s could do anything. And, you know, 400,000 dead Americans later, you know, we paid the price for this. So you have to, I mean, this is human nature, and it doesn't make any difference where it is or who it is. And it can always happen.
Thank you, Jeffrey, so much. It was a great hour. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Jeffrey Lord, contributing editor of the American Spectator, political director in the Ronald Reagan White House, former aide to Jack Kemp. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for all of your calls. We were jammed. Sorry we couldn't get to all of you.